Judges chapter 8. Unexpected opposition. That's this evening's theme that stands out to me. And maybe you'll see it too, or not. But here's Gideon on the brink of total victory, driving out the Midianites, 135,000 warriors of the Midianites had invaded the land of Israel. And with just 300 men, he started their destruction. And then he called the other tribes, and they joined, and the Midianites turning their swords on each other. The other tribes of the Jews then entering the fight. What was left of the Midianite army began to flee back across the Jordan River to get away from the Jews, to get out of the land, and Gideon, with his 300 men, are going to pursue them. And so here he's on the brink of total victory against these invaders, and he's faced with challengers from his own people. You win the war, or you're winning the war, only to find yourself fighting the allies. Obstructors. His own people. Victory can bring battles. But there's a word that stands out in all of this. If I'm in Gideon's place, it's but the 300. They stuck with him all the way. And I think there's a hidden lesson in that. It doesn't take much to support the fight. It just takes enough. In verse 1, now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. Then he said to the men of Succoth, please. Oh, sorry, I got switched up there. Where's verse 2? There you go. And then he said, well, hold on. Let me go back to verse 1. Now the men of Ephraim said to him, "Why have you done this to us by not calling us when you went to fight with the Midianites?" And they reprimanded him sharply. So much for cut and paste. Well, this is taking place again after the slaughter of the Midianite, the major force, the 120,000 of them. And there's always a fly in the ointment. It's like it's part of life. It's just such an irritating part of life that you really have little control over stopping, but you have the opportunity, or we have the opportunity, to learn how to stand up to it. Solomon writes in Ecclesiastes, "Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment and cause it to give off a foul odor. So does a little folly to the one respected for wisdom and honor." So you have this distinguished individual, and they do something a little silly that just kind of ruins everything. Not a harmless silly. There's such a thing as a harmless silly. Then there's also such a thing as a harmful one. Just a little bit of something to mess it up. And that's how it is for Gideon here. He's on this victory. And you would think the men of Ephraim would say, "Yeah, Gideon, thanks for calling us to the battle." But no. They've got a nitpick. They've got a, "Why didn't you call us first?" And there's several reasons for that. He did not call them first. He invited them after the initial rally call. Would they really have followed a farmer? This Ephraim is a very proud tribe. It's a very large and influential tribe amongst the Jews. Would they have come to his aid? Usually, when these kind of criticisms come up, there's something personal in the background pushing it forward that you may never find the reason why. You see this often. Somebody, all of a sudden, they've got a big problem with a little thing. And it's really a big problem to them. They're not letting it go. It's because there was something else there. And they don't want to tell you because they probably guilt, I would assume. In Ephraim's case, what they really were saying is, "We wanted to be called to the fight so we could get the spoils of war, and you didn't call us, so we can't get the best stuff." That's where this is coming from. It's good that Gideon, again, and Israel did not call them to the battle. What would have happened if this proud tribe was told, "You need to go back to your tents because you got down on your hands and knees to drink water, and we're looking for those who are not doing that"? They would have made a bigger problem for everybody. Could have locked, swords. They went to war with Gideon over, "How dare you We got spoils over there in the Midianite camp we want to get our hands on. Who are you to tell us we can't go to war? I don't think Gideon planned it that way. I think he just called these other tribes, not thinking of, he probably said Ephraim's not going to come if I call him. But God saw that, and it was deliberate by God, unintentional oversight by Gideon, not by God. What would have happened if the tribe of Ephraim was told, we're going to war with just 300 of our men and none from Ephraim? And so, he is faced with this now. God, of course, in back of it all, because God said, you had too many men, I want to thin out your ranks, I don't want the people getting the glory, I need to get this glory. Ephraim's going to pull this again as a tribe when we get to Japheth. Japheth. Japheth didn't take any mess from anybody. They messed with the wrong man when they got up in his face, and he slaughtered them. Gideon was not like Japheth. Japheth was not a statesman. Gideon had some class to him, and we see that now, verse 2. So he said to them, what have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? Now remember, the Midianites are getting away. He's got to stop all the operations and deal with this silly protest. Why didn't you call us? But instead of handling it like Japheth, which I kind of like, appeals to my carnal nature, Gideon excels here. He just rises up. His gracious statesmanship averts bloodshed. It would have gotten violent very quickly. They already had their swords on their hips. They're ready. Proverbs 15:1, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up strife. And this is a kind answer he's giving them. He's saying to them, where he says, God has delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb, verse 3. What was I able to do in comparison with you? Then their anger toward him subsided. Now Gideon, he is an Abiezerite. He is, as he says in verse 2, what have I done in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? In that, I guess, proverb, he's saying, you came to war late, so you gleaned, and you captured the two princes of the Midianites. You came in late, but you got the good stuff. Nobody from my town was able to do this. This is outstanding. My hometown boys could not catch these men. You did, and you got the spoils that went with them. And they heard that, and they said, well, you got a good point. See, instead of him locking horns with them and saying, I'm the commander. Who are you to step up here and get in my face like Japheth will do? Gideon just tells them, think about it, guys. You're not missing anything. In fact, you got better stuff than the rest of us. Proverbs 16, he who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. He who rules his spirit than he who takes a city. That ain't me. I wish he who is slow to anger. I'm too quick with the guns. If I were a gunslinger, I'd been dead a long time ago. Somebody faster would have just bumped me off. The hothead. I'm not as hot-headed as I used to be, and I never was totally reckless, but I still noticed that about myself, and maybe you do too, or maybe you're married to one that does, or has noticed it in someone else, but the proverb stands. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty. And here is Gideon, slow to anger. So fantastic a victory that, again, we covered this last session, the psalmist and Isaiah twice will bring up these two men, Oreb and Zeeb, who the children of Ephraim had captured and executed or killed in the battle. So one of the lessons that comes out of all of this is after victory against foes, there can be wars against friends. Confrontations at the least. So you put a double guard up. This is the first of three allied attacks on Gideon. This one was relatively mild, but potentially disastrous. This could have just, again, gotten out of hand. We'll get to the others as we move through. Verse 4, when Gideon came to the Jordan, he and 300 men who were with him crossed over, exhausted, but still in pursuit. Now we go to verse 5 with it. And he said to the men of Succoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. So he had already taken out the princes through the tribe of Ephraim, but the kings had gotten away. But Gideon's not letting them get away with it. He's going after them. He's saying to himself, okay, this ugly mess with Ephraim is now behind me. I can get back on to the business of war against these invaders. Because if these two guys get away, they're just going to regroup and come back next year. He's got to get them. That's his thinking. He needs to finish the job. And that's very admirable about him. And so he's saying, okay, now I can fight the enemies. Wrong. Incidentally, the radius of the battle theater is expanding very rapidly. After he's dealt with Ephraim, he's expanding 25 miles, 35 miles, because we're getting these cities, the names of these cities, and we're charting them from where it all the battle started, until he's 65 miles away. That's where it ends, at Karkor. That's behind enemy lines. God picked 300 men of Gideon, the Gideon guard. That's who's with him, and they are exhausted. Look again, it says exhausted, verse 4, but still in pursuit. Pursuit of what? Complete victory. General MacArthur told one of his generals while he was moving his way towards the Philippines, he said, you have your teeth in him now, don't let go. And he didn't let go, and of course they won. And that's what Gideon is. Gideon says, I got my teeth in them, I'm not letting go. These guys... Gideon's 300 are chasing 15,000 troops out of the land. They don't know it's only 300, but Gideon, he doesn't care. He's just full of the spirit in this war. It is dangerous to underestimate the power of evil, but it is also paralyzing to exaggerate it. You've got to be able to understand what you're up against, but also understand who is with you. And this is the case with Gideon, and this is yet another lesson. So we've gotten a couple of lessons. One is your allies can turn on you over nothing very quickly. And so you set a guard. Your victory against the foe, yes, but confrontation with friends. That's how it is. Don't underestimate the enemy, and don't exaggerate his strength either. They are both counterproductive. And I think in this phrase, exhausted but still in pursuit, is quite beautiful. I have a topical on this from years ago. I probably should give it another shot. Hopefully I'd do better. But is this not a description of Christian perseverance? Exhausted but still going, still chasing, still following the commandments of the Lord. In this little phrase, parallel lessons, they're inescapable. They sit right there waiting for us. A striking application in our own lives. Remembering that exhaustion exceeds tiredness. It goes beyond just being weary. You're now approaching the end of yourself. Maybe there is a season in your life where you are exhausted in your efforts to carry out the Lord's orders. Maybe you are just tired of putting up with someone or something. Perhaps it could be a sickness. Perhaps it is your own flesh. You're just sick and tired of not corralling the flesh. But you still go after the Lord. You still pray. You still read. You still show up to church when you can. You do your duty. You're exhausted, but you're still in pursuit of obedience. You still have to fight also when you reach the enemy. That's another thing. They were exhausted. They're still chasing. Well, what if they caught the enemy in their exhausted state. They'd have to fight like that. It's not, you know, you have to hurry up or else he gets away or he gets in a position where he's going to make it worse for you. And Gideon knows this. They get to a stronghold, what are they going to do? Have to deal with them next year. That's just a thought Gideon is not prepared to embrace. In verse 6, then the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand that we should give you bread to your army? Really not an army, just a company. This is the fruitless fig tree that Jesus dealt with. It promised fruit, but it did not deliver. The fig tree, he saw that it had leaves, which meant the fruit was on the tree, and there was none. And so he cursed the tree. Well, here is Gideon. He sees that he's now in a territory of Gad. He's crossed over Jordan, and this is in Gad's territory. These are his people, and he's asking them for food for the fight. And they're saying, Did you kill these guys yet, or are they still out there? Well, you come back and talk to us when you've got their heads, but until then, we're not giving you anything. Because if you lose this, Gideon, they're going to come after us. Might is more important than right, according to them. They are wrong. Others were risking their lives, but these men of Gad, they were withholding blessings. They were enabling the enemy to get away and to remain strong. Not even a recorded blessing, not even Gideon, we can't help you, but the Lord be with you. Be warm and be filled, God bless you. Not even that. Critical omission, which is an admission of guilt. Yahweh was in none of their thoughts. Each did what was right in his own eyes. Show us their heads. And Gideon, he's tired, he's hungry, he knows he's got these guys. And he's not getting help from where he would have expected it the most. And he's got to face his men. What are they to do? Slaughter Succoth and turn on their own people? Well, he's going to punish them. He's just not going to do it now, which is another lesson that comes out of all of this. Now, you might say, well, the people of Succoth had good reason to fear. No, they did not. The fact that Gideon is chasing a retreating, a full army in full retreat, the fact that he's chasing them out of the land is evidence enough. They should have rallied. We see you got them. They don't offer troops, and he doesn't ask for any. It is remarkable how people of inaction can almost ruin the war, break your heart in the process. They offer him nothing. No food, no troops, no blessing, nothing. In fact, we're told in latter verses, in verse 15, that they even mock him. That probably sealed their fate. So, here is another lesson. He doesn't stay to argue. He doesn't stay to deal with them. He doesn't major in the minors. He majors in the majors. He stays focused on the important things. He goes after the Midianites. The war continues. And here's another lesson. God's forces will march forward without you or with you. It's up to you. It was up to the men of Succoth. They could have joined ranks. They should have joined ranks. Anybody thinks that they're just so important that if they leave the church is going to crumble. I can't tell you how many people have implied that over the years. I'm leaving, and I'll be taking a bunch of people with me. And you'll be out of a job, and you won't be oh, gosh. Satan gets in the heart of the best of us. This was a war that everybody had to take a risk in. They didn't know that they were taking a risk with the wrong side, these men of Succoth. But they were. Well, Gideon was risking his life and his men on the battlefield. It gets worse. Don't worry, it gets worse. Verse 7, so Gideon said, for this cause, when Yahweh has delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. That's probably the point where they started mocking him. Oh, yeah, sure, right. We're shaking in our sandals. But Gideon, knowing how big this army is he's chasing, knowing how small his company is, we're going to take these guys. I don't have to kill the whole army. I just got to kill those two. That's all I've got to do. What a man. Too bad he messes it up. He messes it all up at the end. Not completely, but he does damage. Anyway, this brand of neutrality in the war is going to cost them, and it's going to cost them severely. He could have, again, dealt with them on the spot, but he remains focused. Refusing to help the servants of Israel, they ended up helping the enemies of Israel. What a lesson. Jesus said it this way, "He who is not with me is against me, and he who does not gather with me scatters." And that's the men of Succoth. And don't worry, as I mentioned, there's more. Verse 8, "Then he went up from there to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered." More countrymen from Gad. Again, he's 6 miles hungrier and more tired and more irritated. He's got to be asking himself, what is with these people? Idolatry is with these people. That's what. He's saying, is it me? Is it me? Why am I the only one that can understand? I've got my teeth in these guys and I can't let them go. Don't you see the enemy is in full retreat? It's not even a sensible retreat. They're not even setting guards to slow us down. They think that they just need to pell-mell out of here and they're safe. And that's going to be the enemy's downfall. Verse 8. "So he also spoke to the men of Penuel, saying, 'When I come back in peace, I will tear down this tower.'" He will, and it's going to hurt, but he's going to hit them where it hurts. He reminds us a little bit of Nehemiah. He just doesn't play around at this point. But he's going to do more damage to them than they're ready for. There's going to be blood. So he gives them a heads up. And he says, you can't be neutral. Not in this. You will be scourged for it. Verse 10. "Now Ziba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their armies with them, about 15,000, all who were left of all the army of the people of the east, for 120,000 men who drew the sword had fallen." That's 135 warriors, 120 killed already and being killed probably as this is going on west of Jordan, back in the promised land. And he's in Karkor. We know Karkor is in enemy territory. So that's how far he chased them. Gideon is outnumbered 50 to 1. The size of he's got 2% of their army. It's just 300 divided into 15,000. He's at 2%. 11% of the Midianite army has survived. And he doesn't have to wipe out the whole army. He just has to take out the leaders. Incidentally, Karkor means flat or a plateau. So it's an ideal battlefield and it's an ideal campground, but it doesn't offer any coverage. We're not going to be told how Gideon gets these two guys, but I'm suspecting there was, a night mission involved. They just swooped in and took them captive and went on. Because it just, I mean, you can't, 300 men just can't kill 15,000 men with a sword. Not in a day. I mean, you're going to get tired. Even if you're eating a sandwich while you're just chopping them up, you just can't. So it would be foolish for us to think that he will not annihilate them. He'll do some damage to some of them, but he gets away with it. Verse 11. "Then Gideon went up by the road of those who dwell in tents on the east of Nabah and Jogbetha, and he attacked the army while the camp felt secure." Well, the road, where it says the road of those who dwell in the tents, that's a caravan route. And he is surprised. The reason why he gets the advantage of a surprise attack is because they let their guard down. They're like, we're out of Israel's territory. We're not even in Gad's territory now. We're in our, Arab land. And they felt pretty good about themselves. They did not have, they couldn't, I guess, you know, if Gideon had several hundred thousand men with him, they would have kicked up enough dust to be seen, but 300 men, get away with it. And he, surprise, verse 12, well, let me go back, let's see. He attacked the army while the camp felt secure. Another lesson for us, don't feel secure. You can have peace for a while without feeling secure. It's just a mindset. You understand. You set your guards. Verse 12, then Zeba and Zalmunna fled and pursued them, and he took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and routed the whole army. He doesn't say annihilate them or slaughter them. He defeats them somehow, some way. What probably happened, they're engaged with the enemy. Once they capture the two kings, which really wouldn't have been too difficult in this sense. I mean, I wouldn't want to try it. I wouldn't advise you. But the kings would have had their garb on and been identifiable. Or even if they didn't, they would have been able to determine where the kings were by how much the enemy concentrated defense around those people. And so they identified them. They attacked them. Once they captured the kings, the rest of the army would not have had a stomach for the fight. They're afraid that their kings would have been killed. So they all went back to their houses in defeat. We see this throughout Scripture. And the story has to be believable unless we are told that there's another miracle involved, which this is a form. It's miraculous. It's certainly fantastic. He routed the whole army, not annihilated it. He defeated it. And verse 13, then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from battle from the ascent of Heres. Now, the King James, the old King James Version, interprets Heres as, the word means the sun. But those who handle the words and other translators, they've not interpreted it that way. I think the King James has missed the translation. It is the ascent of the sun. The word is used elsewhere in Judges. So anyway, it's just a small thing. If you're reading from the King James Version and you've listened to me read the verse, you've said, hey, mine says from the sun was up. It's probably not a very good translation. If just say the King James is the right one and all the other ones are wrong, you've not really lost anything. It's not a contradiction. You go to the original language and its tenses. It's not enough to just have the words. You have to understand how the words work together. And that's how the translators do their thing. And we should be very grateful for them. Not the wicked ones. Incidentally, Jehovah Witnesses, Watchtower, they don't have translators. They have paraphrasers. That's what they have. They're plagiarists. They have interpreters. But they do not have translators of the original languages. Verse 14, because let me just move forward. Verse 14, so he caught a young man of the men of Succoth and interrogated him, and he wrote down for him the leaders of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. Gideon is finished with the enemy. He's still got these two prisoners. Nobody's going to try to come and take them back. They're not that interested in them. Plus, Gideon can kill them at any point, and that would defeat the purpose. But he's going to deal with Gad before he heads back home across the east of Jordan. And he catches this young man, and he says, hey, you're from Succoth. We're going to let you live if you tell us who are the decision makers in your village. So the guy starts singing like a canary. He starts telling them, well, there's Joe Smocatelli. And he just goes down the list. What would you do in that way? I never really liked those guys anyway. I saw when you showed up. They should have gave you some biscuits or something. But anyhow, Gideon is taking names. This is deliberate, premeditated, and well done. Their action was inexcusable. I mean, it couldn't give bread to their own people fighting the enemy. Probably a sizable village. Verse 15. Then he came to the men of Succoth and said, here are Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you ridiculed me. saying, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in your hand, that we should give bread to your weary men? Remember that? Remember you did? That was just a few. You remember we stood there, we were parched, we were exhausted, we were hungry. Me and the 300, here we were. Ready to fight, though. We were still ready to fight. But you people, you're not backstabbers, you're face slappers. You insult us. You do us harm in a cowardly way. And now, it's time for payback. Success is sweet revenge. That's what Gideon is saying. He's got these two kings here. He's saying, here they go, boy, I told you I was going to be back. Had to be a sickening feeling in the men of Succoth's stomach, especially when Gideon pulls out the list. If I call your name, take one step forward. Verse 16, I don't know, I'm enjoying this. And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. Now, when he says, of course, he taught the men of Succoth, he didn't say, now this is a briar. It grows in an arid land, doesn't need full sun. It has a yellow flower in the spring. He does not give them that kind of lesson. He's beating them up. He may be killing them. We get that because that's what he's going to do at Penuel. It says that. Some of the commentators believe that the way you thrash wheat, he did to them with these thorns and briars. I don't know if they got enough this basis from the text to say that. But anyway, briar beatings and taking names. That's Gideon at this point. He was really, really disturbed by how he and his men were treated. Gives new meaning to Hebrews chapter 13, where the writer says, let brotherly love continue. Then he goes on to say, do not forget to entertain strangers, for by doing, some have unwittingly entertained angels. Well, in this case, it wasn't an angel, it was Gideon. The writer is talking about Abraham. Abraham received the strangers from heaven. He didn't know they were at the beginning, but he found out later. And so the writer to Hebrews says, as Christians, you don't know who's in front of you. God may bring somebody into your life, and it's the Lord. You better be careful. You better have that brotherly love. Well, there was no brotherly love coming from Succoth and Penuel towards Gideon. In verse 17, then he tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. He could have done this again, first time, when they said no, but he had bigger fish to fry, stayed focused. He stayed focused. You irritate people when you stay focused, sometimes, some people. You say, no, that's not the mission. This is the mission. It's a good mission. Let's get it done. And they're like, but you've got them right in your hands. It's not the mission. Stay with this. And that's Gideon. Sort of David, you know, in the cave, like, you got Saul, kill him. While he was sleeping, I'll drive my spear right through the ground and just kill him. And David is just focused. Nope, God made him king. God can take him out. Now, I'm not doing it. And I'm sure that there were those that were inconvenienced by that. Abishai probably said, you know, I'm getting tired of being chased by Saul. David, just kill the guy. We can just get on with the whole nation thing. And David is, no, I'm king, and this is how I'm doing it. I've got this in my heart, and I'm not going to give it up for you. You make enemies that way. You make enemies out of even nice people and people who you wish didn't feel the way they felt. Verse 18, and he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, what kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor, Mount Tabor area? So they answered, as you are, so were they. Each one resembled the son of a king. So Gideon's dialoguing with these two kings he's captured. He's contemplating, you know, what am I going to do with them? Am I just going to kill them? Because if it were just that easy, he would have killed them. And, of course, there's time lapsing between these events. Gideon is home now. He's not at Succoth or Penuel. We know that because the following verses, Gideon's son shows up. He's a lad, and he certainly wasn't on the battlefield with them. So he's now home. There's been a return to his hometown. And in addition to ravaging the land, the Midianites were murdering people. Remember, we read about the people hiding in caves from them. And the local population being oppressed is serious stuff. I mean, imagine if it was happening in your neighborhood. Invaders from another country coming and killing people and nobody able to do anything about it. We're not told when or where these murders, Tabor area, we're not told when they took place. But these kings owned it. And they answered the question, yep, we did it. And Gideon says, what kind of men were they? Were they like peasants or were they renowned men of stature? And the king said they were like, the Midianite kings, they were like kings. They had a regal manner about them. So they confessed to killing them. Then verse 19, surprise. And he said, Gideon speaking, they were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if you had let them live, I would not kill you. So Gideon, you see the look on their faces when he says, you know, they weren't my like brothers of my country. They were actually my brothers. Same mom. And you killed them. And this is not, you know, nepotism is the undue favor of family. When you slight everybody else to a fault, it becomes a crime because you're so busy looking out for your family. I mean, there are times you have to look out for your family, of course. I'm not saying you're not supposed to, but you can certainly abuse that. And Gideon is not abusing it. He has a right to kill these men as an avenger of blood, according to Numbers 35, clearly laid out in the law. These men were not only invaders, they were murderers. And not only that, they were murderers of Gideon's family, which may explain why he was hiding out in the wine press, thrashing wheat, because, you know, it had struck home. His family had been killed, and he was, you know, he knew that he better not take chances. Verse 20, and he said to Jether, his firstborn, rise and kill them. But the youth would not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Well, youth, by definition, is inexperience. Maybe, we're not told his age, but maybe Gideon shouldn't have put the kid on the line like this. You know, I'll make a man out of you, boy. Just kill these two guys for me. Anyway, before we get back to that, how a soldier died in battle meant a lot, even to this day. I mean, you don't want to die in battle, you know, backing up a Jeep in the rear or get hit by a truck. I mean, if you're going to die, let it be on the battlefield in a blaze of glory. Not trying to romanticize war. There's nothing romantic about war. Anyway, it was important to their reputation. Abimelech, who is Gideon's son through a concubine, we'll get him in next chapter, not a good person. He did not want to die at the hands of a woman. She threw a stone off from the wall and clunked him in his noggin, and he was dying, and he knew it. And he had someone kill him. Saul, he did not want to die at the hands of the Philistines. So he asked, of course, his armor bearer to kill him, which he certainly refused to do. So if you're a king and someone is asking a child to kill you, that's an insult. And that would have been just a humiliation those two kings certainly would not have wanted. And inexperienced, he doesn't know where to begin. Son, kill him, and he's not. He's not moving. What do I do with this guy? You know, can't you give him poison, Dad? Verse 21. So Ziba and Zalmunna said, "Rise yourself and kill us, for as a man is, so is his strength." So Gideon arose and killed Ziba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments that were on their camels' necks. This was apparent sarcasm intended to provoke Gideon to kill them. They knew if this lad all of a sudden decided, okay, let me try, he's going to hack them up. And it would have been a torturous, gruesome, slow and painful death, more than likely. And this is in his, even you have, you know, professional henchmen mess it up. where they don't hang the guy the right way. They go to chop the head off and they miss to get the back, I mean, the side of the head. So they knew about this, and they wanted Gideon to just get this over with. And they probably provoked him because, you know, they killed his brothers. It didn't take much to make Gideon say, fine, and go ahead and kill them. They were wise in doing that, as men go, and that's the end of those two men, verse 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the land of Midian. They offered him a hereditary monarchy, a dynasty. Your whole family, your family will reign over for us forever. That's kind of the spirit here. Shows you how great a victory this was. I mean, he was just a star at this point in the nation. Gideon, nobody else could do this. For years, Midian's been coming in, and here you come, and you beat them all up. We want you to be king. And it's not, of course, the first and only time this has happened in history. One of the key themes of the book of Judges is that there was no king in Israel. The historian, the scribes who published the final print that we have, or at least what contributed to it, recognized this, recognized that there was tribal division, there was corruption, moral corruption, and that a king would very likely be able to stabilize this, because the judges were not over all the people all the time. Well, mainly their tribes and surrounding tribes, but with perhaps the exception of Othniel, they really were not ruling over all the people as a king would. And that's why we read in Judges 18, 19, 21, and 17, well, I'll take 17, Judges 17, 6, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. So the historian is saying it would have been nice if the Jews recognized it, if they could just have a king now. Well, eventually that's what's going to happen. The period of Judges ends by a king coming into play, and that would be Saul. Samuel was, you know, he didn't like the idea at all, and God overruled Samuel gently. Don't worry about it, Samuel. There's no slight on you. Now, they don't like you, the last judge. I understand that. But they want a king, so give them one. I think the Lord did not appreciate how they went about getting a king. They didn't come to God. They didn't say, let's ask God. They just kind of demanded. And in the end, the worst part is, we want a king like the other nations. That's probably what stood out in Samuel's ear. That would have stood out in my ear. If someone said, you know, we don't want a pastor, we want a rabbi, like, you know, some other, you know, we want a shaman or something, it would be, man, that's, after all those years of teaching, this is what I get back. That would have how I would feel. Samuel had to be feeling that because he taught the people. And he probably said, I went around on a circuit educating you about Yahweh, and this is the best I get back. Now, that's how it is. Not everybody, but enough to hurt. Verse 23, but Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. Yahweh shall rule over you. Yay, Gideon, not so fast. Gideon knew the restrictions on kings, and the one that events show that he didn't like, it's not explicitly said, it doesn't take much to do the math. Gideon liked women. I mean, he really liked them. And if he were king and he was to be compliant with the law of Moses, Deuteronomy 17, then he couldn't add to his household wives. So he acts here as though, no, God is our king and I'd rather not. But really he is saying, I'm going to live like a king without the headaches, without the restrictions. That's what the events will unfold for us in one moment. In fact, his son, Abimelech, who we had just referenced a minute ago, his name means my father is king. And there's a reference in Judges 9. In fact, Judges 9, verse 2. Please speak in the hearing of all the men of Shechem, which is better for you, that all 70 of the sons of Jerubbabel, that's Gideon, reign over you, or that one reign over you. Remember that I am your own flesh and bone. See, Abimelech wanted to be king. 70 kids. That's how many children. Some of you boast about how many children you have, and that's noble and is wonderful. But it's not 70. You'll see where I'm going with that when I get it. I mean, what man at that age, at that period of time, would not want to say, I've got 70 sons? I mean, sons and guns, that's what it's all about. Verse 24, and the Bible's not even trying to be comical, but there's humor everywhere. I mean, as the generations go by and you look at something, you look at the Renaissance. You know those flat pancake hats like Martin Luther wore and the coat like King Henry VIII and his tights? They look goofy. But back then, that was hot stuff. Anyway, verse 24, then Gideon said to them, I would like to make a request of you, that each of you would give me the earrings from his plunder, for they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites. Well, the Ishmaelites as a people, and also Midianites all in there, they liked the earrings, some nose rings, and the crescent shapes, and it would be on their camels, you know, the gaudy camels. You look at how they decorate their buses in Pakistan. To me, it's gaudy. To them, it's beautiful. To each their own. The Ishmaelites, Amalekites, Midianites, they like the jewelry. And let's just hope it doesn't catch on in the Christian community. It's kind of whisper it, because next thing you know, men become in the church with crescents in their nose. Anyway, I was thinking today, I was saying, when did I start hating the wardrobe that we see today? And it was back in the 80s. I remember them showing up, which, yeah, I know many of you love that, you know, my daughter comes, oh, look, Dad, I brought jeans, and they have a hole in them. And to me, that's reprehensible. I think we should get our money back. But that's the style. And I detest the style. I protest the style. I do everything I can to express my utter contempt for it. But I love the people who dress like that. I love bums. I'm being humorous. Please, no hate mail. I'm just joking. I really don't mind. As long as you don't force me to dress like you, I really don't mind. And if you're clean. Now, if flies start hovering around you, we're going to have issues. But anyway, back to this. The people made a request of Gideon. I mean, it's bad when your dress clothes and your pajamas is the same thing. Okay, I can let it go. Somebody's going to really be out there waiting for me with a stick in their hand. So they make this request of Gideon, and Gideon makes a request of them. Verse 25, so they answered, we will gladly give them these nose rings and such. And they spread out a garment, and each man threw into it the earrings from his plunder. Now, the weight of the gold earrings that was requested was 1,700 shekels of gold, besides the crescent ornaments, pendants, and purple robes, which were on the kings of Midian, and besides the chains that were around their camels' necks. Camels were gaudy, too. So this is the plunder that came to Gideon. He's going to live like a king. This is a golden parachute. I mean, he retires filthy rich. It's probably not every single man. Some probably already went home, but it was enough of them. He's got 40 pounds of gold, the calculation of all of this. Verse 27, then Gideon made it into an ephod and set it up in his city, Ophrah, and all Israel played the harlot with it there. It became a snare to Gideon and to his house. What? What was he thinking? All of the victories, God speaking to him. What is he thinking? And this, again, the operative word has been for the last few verses, gaudy. He makes this ephod. It's more than just a gaudy lawn ornament. Whatever he had in mind, who knows what he was thinking. I don't think he was thinking idolatry. I think he had other thoughts, perhaps pride. Perhaps he thought he could center their attention on something other than the pagans surrounding them. That backfired. And one of the lessons that comes out of this is even if your motives are sound, your actions can be wrong, way wrong. And good intentions are not always God intentions. And a lot of Christians, we don't learn this lesson. This is why people protest. It's like, I know you think it's a good idea. Because all you can see is your idea. And to you, it's good. And no one can challenge it. In fact, those who have the decision-making powers are now obligated to carry out your plan. And if they don't, Uzzah had a good idea. He was going to steady the Ark of the Covenant so it didn't fall off the cart, and he was struck dead. King David had a good idea. He's going to build a temple of God. And God told him, no, I don't want any association with the man who shed blood on the battlefield. I don't want people to think that that's my ideal. I'll be charged with it anyway, but it won't stick. Peter, he had a good idea. He was going to give Malchus two heads. Just that poor aim. And of course, the Lord rebukes him. You know, you live by the sword, Peter, you die. That's not the way we do business. There are times I'm disappointed in that. It's like, Lord, but this would really help the situation because you're taking too long to take people out I don't like. I don't really feel that way, but I could see myself going there. Remember that whole hothead thing? Anyway, Paul, the beloved Apostle Paul, James speaking to Paul, I've got a good idea. Pay their vows. Take them down to the... It was a bad idea. It was terrible. Paul should have said, you know, James, you haven't even said thank you to the Gentiles who sent the cash. So, just to have a good idea is not enough. This certainly had a sad ending. Gideon's influence, it's very puzzling. And there are a few of these puzzling things in the book of Judges. But I don't think it's idolatry because Gideon is applauded in verse 28, the next verse we get to, with defeating the Midianites, the enemies of God's people, those who were pagans. He brought in quietness or peace from war. The fact that the idolatry, we're told in verse 33, really kicked in after his death is very significant in his favor. And the commendation at the end of the chapter, they all add up to that Gideon probably had good intentions, may have had some pride, but it was just a bad idea all the way around. We'll come across a silver ephod when we get to chapters 17 and 18. He says, all Israel played the harlot. He doesn't mean, because of what I just read, that they played it instantly as soon as it went up. He set the groundwork for it. And the historian is inserting that and saying this was not a good idea. All Israel, here they come with their biscuits to sop up the idolatry. I know I got that one a few weeks ago. I'm not letting it go. I plan to keep it forever because that, to me, is the picture of what people do when they turn away from God's word. They just sop up everything else they get to. As someone just wipes up the gravy off a plate with a biscuit. He goes on, all Israel played the harlot. That's how God looks at it. It's an unfaithfulness. It's a spiritual prostitution. It is unacceptable. You're selling yourselves. You're selling your souls. You're not getting anything back that is noble or high or good or righteous or anything that one would want for themselves. And so what any further details on this ephod, we're really not given. The ephod for the priest, of course, was the vest that also had the breastplate
with it. That was also the ephod. You remember David put a linen ephod on, but it wasn't the breastplate of righteousness. It wasn't the entire package. It was just the linen vest that showed a deference to the priesthood. And it was not David saying, I have the authority of the priesthood. He kept it separate. And although he did have, as king, he did exercise authority over the organization of the priesthood, not their rights, but he put them into divisions so that they could carry out their duties fairly. But he never usurped the priesthood. That's where I wanted to go. Verse 28, thus Midian was subdued before the children of Israel so that they lifted their heads no more, and the country was quiet for 40 years in the days of Gideon. See, that God gave them peace. If their idolatry had been full-blown at this point, then they would have been judged again. One other thing about this is that this is the last time we find an extended period of peace in the book of Judges. After that, it's just not long-lived at all. The fact that he took out those two kings is, this is commentary on that. Had he not taken the two kings of Midian out, they would have come back the next year or the year after, but he did succeed. Verse 29, then Zerubbabel, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Yeah, Gideon, the name that was given to him, let Baal defend himself if he's all that. Here, Gideon had his father's altar taken down, and it's, you know, the accompanying the ancillary device next to it. But then he puts up the ephod. You just got to say, you know, what happens inside of somebody's head? I'm sure he could explain it. If we had tonight, we have a guest speaker. Gideon, come on up here and explain to us what you were trying to do with the ephod. I'm sure he could come up and make a convincing argument, and then we could counter with, yeah, well, the facts show that it was a disaster. Verse 29, verse 30 now. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. Yeah, how many wives did you have to have 70 sons? I tried to do some math on this, so this is what I did. This is why he refused the throne, because he didn't want this restriction. Or we'll go to verse 31. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son whose name was Abimelech. Okay, so that's how we know where Abimelech's coming from next chapter. But King Mangut of Siam, he had 32 wives plus concubines. And he had 82 children. So to get 82 children, you got to have about 32 women. If you're going to go by as a template, his son did even more. So Gideon has 70 sons. So he's probably had about 25, you know. So when I go back and I say, well, Gideon says, you know, God, Yahweh will be your king. It's, events, they contradict, your actions contradict your speech, Gideon. This is not the worst thing that could, I mean, in our age, of course, looking back, it's reprehensible. But back then, it wasn't that all that bad. Bat him on the back. He probably said, you know what, it was good that you didn't become king, because this would have been a really big problem. But don't worry, Gideon, Solomon is going to blow you out of the water. This is the fact of life. Can't sweep it under the rug. The Bible makes no effort to do that. Tells you how it is. And leaves it for us to find the application in the Spirit without violating the commandments, the statutes, the ordinances laid down for us in the New Testament or laid down in the Old Testament, ratified by the New Testament. If it's laid down in the Old Testament but it's not ratified in the New Testament, really not an ordinance we are obligated. Not talking about moral law. Thou shalt not kill is for every age, Old and New Testament. Well, verse 32. Now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash's father in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So the wording about the man is supports the fact that he was not up to no good. He just messed up. And this reputation that he had was outstanding. tragically, having those, the Bible does not support polygamy. In fact, in every case, it's a failure. Of his 69 sons, all but one was killed. Abimelech just kills him. So, and then himself was killed. So it's not, it doesn't have a happy ending. Verse 33, so it was as soon as Gideon was dead that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baals and made Baal Berith their god. And so there, after Gideon's out of the way, they have, he's not, there's no inhibitor. They just turn loose, and idolatry is the result. He didn't help matters on this note, even though he wanted to. It makes all of us say, oh, let me be careful. Let me think about what I'm doing here. Let me not take liberties. If I got a mixed feeling about it, it's probably because there's a warning, there's an alarm going off. Verse 34, thus the children of Israel did not remember Yahweh their God, who had delivered them from the hands of their enemies on every side. Nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbabel, Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. So you see, it ends with an up note on Gideon. The last two verses, you know, really applaud the man, which allows us to say, well, the whole ephod thing was poor judgment, but not likely in his heart to worship false gods. So that ends this evening's consideration. Next week, Lord willing, we'll get Abimelech. And that'll be fun watching him get dealt with. Let's pray. Our Father, we do rejoice in justice, but we also are aware that we ourselves are in such need of a Savior in the blood of Christ. And may we not be self-righteous. Realistic, yes, Lord, as best we could be, but may we not be mean-spirited or self-righteous, but may we be full of the Spirit and pursue love even when exhausted, and may it get us home safely tonight. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.